Blog Talk Radio.
The flagship of Fighting Words Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. Tonight we're joined by Ty. Ty, how are you tonight?
I'm doing well. Doing well, Frankie. How are you doing tonight?
Good, good. So, a lot happening in the world of the pugilist world. Malik Scott just fought. I don't know if you saw that fight.
Malik Scott had a pretty short go of it against Deontay Wilder, losing the first round. Malik Scott took a lot of heat after that fight. A lot of people, keyboard warriors, I like to call them, blamed him and thought he threw the fight. They didn't see a clean, hard punch he got hit with. Though he did get hit with a left hook, it was a bit of a slapping hook. But, Frankie, a slapping hook from a 6'8", 230-pound man could be quite debilitating. So.
Yeah, and Malik is a class act. I don't, because I saw a lot of that, and people were, he took a dive, You know, I don't think Malik would ever take a dive.
Yeah. And, here's what people have to realize, too. Malik has been a class pro for a long time. He only had one loss. It was a controversial, very extremely controversial stoppage in England in Derek Chisora's backyard when he was fighting. So, I mean, his chance at going on and facing possibly the winner of Areola Saverne, had he beaten Deontay Wilder, would have been right there with supposedly for an eliminator. So it stands to reason why a guy would throw an eliminator fight, a fight that could propel him to the next level of title championship. But stranger things have happened.
Yeah, it was a very short fight. Like you said, it was, I think, a minute 38.
And I think, too, the kind of the thing that got – it's a little sad is that Deontay Wilder now is like 31-0 with 31 knockouts, and he still truly hasn't been tested. We still don't know what the kid has. We still don't know if he can take a punch. We know he's been dropped in his career, but we still don't know if he can take a punch, if he can beat a guy who's really fighting him back. And a lot of us thought Malik Scott would be the one who would pose these questions and possibly get these questions answered in the ring, just Deontay, and
right.
didn't come to be. So again, the jury's still out on Deontay Wilder. We'll know more when he faces the winner of Stavern Ariola.
Yeah, we're joined right now by Butch as well.
Hey,
guys.
Butch.
Yeah, we're getting warmed up for the Orlando game here. Tampa Bay is playing Orlando for the number one spot in the AFL. Right now, Voss is talking. Derek Brooks is talking to a bunch of our Storm players from my little Storm team. Just to let you know that Ty's team won the Division II today in the spring football team. So I'm going to send a big hello out to Ty because I know he's listening in the car on the way up. But Dan Birmingham is a terrific person, the guy you're going to have on tonight. And we're also going to have Kathy Duva on, who's supposed to call in. If she doesn't call in tonight, she'll be on Wednesday night's show. So we're going to break here, and I just want to tell you guys a good show, and I'll talk to you after the game.
Okay.
Hey, thanks, Butch. Nice to hear from you, brother.
Goodbye.
That nephew of mine, Ty, is just—he's a monster on the football field.
Yeah, I keep hearing.
Absolute monster.
It would be quite a coup. It would be quite a coup, honestly, if we could get if Kathy Duva would call in tonight, because tonight she has the gem of her bag, so to speak, Sergey Kovalev, going tonight on the HBO triple header as a main event. So I would assume she's pretty busy right now.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that. There's a lot of controversy that surrounded that, that whole fight, with HBO and their past experience or relationship with Sergey.
Ah, okay.
I don't know if you saw any of that.
I did not.
Yeah, it was all over money.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, he's fighting tonight, and really, I mean, is Cedric Agnew really much of a challenge for the guy?
Well, Cedric Agnew is rated number 15 in the world in the weight. He's 26-0, 13 knockouts. Unfortunately, he hasn't fought the level of competition that would necessarily warrant a shot against Kovalev. So it leads you to believe that this fight is somewhat of a showcase for Kovalev. But a lot of times you get an undefeated challenger, a guy who hasn't lost his first chance for glory, and all of a sudden you get a good fight on your hands. I think the Danny Garcia-Mauricio Herrera fight showed that any fighter in the ring steps in with two fists has a chance to really, make something special happen that night for himself and for his career. I think the thing with Sergey Kovalev is the fight that HBO really wants is Sergey and Adonis Stevenson. The problem is Adonis Stevenson has just left HBO to go to Showtime because he said, there's more money. He was offered a better deal. The general thought in the blog sphere in regards to Adonis Stevenson is that he's kind of avoiding a fight with Sergey Kovalev. Zito spoke on that last week, that Kovalev's name did not come out of Adonis Stevenson's mouth, even though Kovalev had called Adonis Stevens out in the ring that same night. After his fight. So, again, these are prize fighters. It seems as though, Adonis Stevenson is making a prize move, not necessarily a pride move. So, HBO didn't want his title defense against Fonfara. Fonfara is pretty familiar to us because Fonfara actually got a win over our own boy, Glenn Johnson, about a year ago. So that's where we know Anthony Fonfara from. He was supposed to fight Adonis Stevenson. HBO didn't want the fight. Showtime took the fight. And so, again, with Adonis Stevenson going to Showtime and Kovalev fighting on HBO, it pushes that fight further and further apart because of the promotional Cold War. So,
yeah, but who's going to fight Stevenson? I mean, really, there's not a lot of people of note in the division,
Well, there is one guy, and Stevenson is going to go ahead and fight Fonseca. He'll probably fight him on Showtime. And I think with Showtime, what Golden Boy would really like to see happen is they like to see Bernard Hopkins go ahead and beat Velvet Chumanev, who he's fighting up in May. Or is it the end of April? I forget offhand. But if Bernard were to beat Velvet Chumanev, then it could be a possibility of a fight between Adonis Stevenson and Bernard Hopkins. Bernard is the name of the division at this point.
Right.
And that was one of the names Adonis Stevenson called out. Another thing, too, about Bernard Hopkins is because of his fights with Jean Pascal and the fact that the first fight was a draw, the second fight was his victory, but a lot of people thought he won the first fight. More importantly, the way he performed in those fights, he was more aggressive. He attacked more. He was a much more entertaining fighter than the crowd had given him credit for before. So, subsequently, Montreal's been kind of like a second home to Bernard Hopkins. So a fight between Bernard Hopkins and Adonis Stevenson in Montreal could be a very, very big fight, very lucrative fight. And I could see the promoters angling things that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, there's talk of Andre Ward may be possibly moving up. Julio Cesar Chavez may be moving up.
Julio Cesar Chavez is going to stay at 168, and more than likely on July 19th, it's very close to being a done deal. He will be fighting one, Gennady Golovkin. So, you know, fans really look forward to that. Yeah, that's the fight that is very close to done. Bob Arum has already even talked about a $1 million penalty if Chavez were to come in overweight. So they're down to that. I mean, the fight is just about done. It was originally going to be put together for July 12th. Now they're looking at July 19th, but that fight is extremely close to being done.
Yeah, but we've learned time and time again, you know, done fights are not often done fights.
Nah, but you know what? I think if this is a fight Bob Arum has wanted Chavez to take, I think he looks at it as a lucrative fight. More than likely, Bob Arum is smart enough that if he takes this fight with Golovkin and Chavez, that he may even put options on Golovkin. So I could see him doing that. It would be a smart thing to do. And we know Bob Arum looks to line his own pocket, so I don't see why he wouldn't consider it unless K2 management kind of prohibits that. But at the same time, I think when Bob Arum looks at a Chavez Jr., he kind of has to be fair and look at the ceiling. Chavez Jr., because of his work ethic or lack thereof, his ceiling could have very well have been that Sergio Martinez fight. So this could be, in essence, a cash-out fight for Bob Arum in regards to Chavez Jr. Even if Chavez Jr. doesn't perform too well, even if he's, you know, outside of him being blown away, he still could be an attraction because of his name and the fact that when he prepares to fight, he comes to fight. He's an entertaining fighter. But I think Bob Arum is honestly, I wouldn't say he's throwing into the wolves, but I think he believes Chavez has reached the ceiling. He may look at Gennady Golovkin as being a little small and think this would be the best, you know, opportunity for a focused Chavez to get a really good scalp on his resume. But outside of that, I think, you know, it's just a money fight. It's a money grab for Bob Arum. And it's, you know, a money grab that gives him the best chance to win a fight because Golovkin's coming up to 168. A fight between Chavez and Andre Ward doesn't necessarily make as much money as Chavez and Golovkin, and it's probably a more risky proposition fight for Chavez style-wise. So.
Right. Well, you feel there's any danger in the fight for Chavez, or you think this is something he's just going to walk over?
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, I don't think Chavez is going to win the fight. I think Golovkin will handle 168 well. I think because it's 168 and Chavez is such a big guy, I do think he'll definitely make a go of it. But I see Golovkin, sharper technique, and just being the better overall boxer. And the one thing Golovkin is he's definitely more professional, just being the more professional boxer. The more professional boxer outside the ring, just being a more professional, having a more professional approach to the game, I believe is enough for him to beat a Chavez, who's not always 100% focused or 100% dedicated.
Do you think we'll see Golovkin fighting Kovalev?
You know, there are rumors because these guys sparred a little bit. They fought, you know, they have a history together. But there are rumors that Golovkin knocked Kovalev down with a body shot in sparring. And part of Golovkin's awe, yeah, man, part of the awe with Golovkin is the fact that he has some South California gym wars where he's, you know, handled some pretty credible fighters, including Chavez. There are rumors that, you know, he was pushing Chavez around in the ring. Now, again, Chavez shows up for fights not 100% all the time, so we know in training he's not giving 100%.
Right.
Nonetheless, Golovkin's reputation really developed over the way he would handle himself against world-class opposition in sparring. That's where the underground hardcore surge for him to start, you know, becoming a phenomenon as far as, you know, the media started to come from. It came from his underground roots, you know, the fact that people would see these gym wars, different writers, and they would start writing about him. So he kind of became this boogeyman that everyone wanted to hear about, like the Kaiser Soze of boxing, so to speak.
Right.
So, you know, so that's kind of what Golovkin became before, you know, he was fighting on HBO and these things. And so he's the real deal. And I honestly expect him to beat Chavez. I don't think he's big enough personally to go up to light heavyweight and fight at Kovalev at this point. But I do think he beats anyone at 160, including Martinez. And I think he's a handful for a lot of people at 168. Could he beat Andre Ward? I don't know. I like to see him against Chavez first. But Andre Ward is the kind of guy that when he's in the ring and he's sharp, you know, he's got every tool in the toolbox. And Golovkin hasn't shown that yet. He hasn't even been faced with someone. In fact, Chavez will probably, at 168, will probably be his stiffest competition. So, again, there are questions about Golovkin that we'll get answered with that fight, hopefully.
Yeah, it's you're right. I mean, Golovkin, there's a lot of buzz around him. The kid definitely comes to fight. The one thing you get with Golovkin is he's leaving it in the ring. You know, he's bringing it and he's leaving it.
Yeah. You know, one thing that is really solid about Golovkin, and the funny thing is it's kind of ironic he would be fighting Chavez Jr. because, you know, Zito and I talked about it. When you look at Golovkin, Golovkin fights more like Chavez Sr. than Chavez Jr. does.
Right.
Just in a subtle technique, a subtle use of forearms to parry punches. And you know what? He has very, very deft feet. Not the quickest feet, just like Chavez Jr., but very deft feet in that he's subtle at taking that little half step to the left or to the right to cut off the ring on an opponent. Something Chavez doesn't do. Chavez, if you remember against Sergio Martinez, he kind of followed him around basically for 12 rounds. Golovkin doesn't do that. He cuts the ring off, and he gradually makes the ring smaller and smaller in incremental steps. And so, you know, he reminds me a little bit of Chavez in that when you watch him, you don't necessarily see with your eyes a tremendous athlete. You know what I mean? Like, as far as athleticism go, he doesn't really wow you on the eye test. But as far as knowing the sweet science, Frankie, and knowing the techniques, you watch him and you say, man, this guy does a lot of little subtle things that puts him in position to not only attack and punch, but also puts him in a position to defend, too, at times. So there's a little bit more to his aggression than people see.
Yeah, and they're talking about the fight being in July.
Yeah, they're looking at July 19th.
July 19th.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, Chavez Jr., when he's focused, he's always entertaining because he comes to fight. But this is going to be interesting because both guys like to come forward. Both guys like to attack and hit the body. Again, I believe Golovkin has sharper technique, and he's the better all-around overall boxer, and I think that will, you know, allow him to see the day.
Yeah, I'm going to just say that I think you're right. I think Chavez is going to he's going to lose his fight, but I don't know. It could go to the cards. It depends on which Chavez shows up. You know, he does. And it's sad because his dad was such an overwhelming force in the ring, and so Chavez has been as well to an extent. But you're right. He's not his dad. He's not the same type of boxer as his dad. You can see see his dad's influence in his boxing, but you're right. He doesn't have that vision that Golovkin seems to have, where, you know, Golovkin, you know, is thinking 10 punches ahead, and he knows where he's got to put you, and he knows how he wants to get you there. And Golovkin's a chess player. He will get you in position, and then he will end you.
And again, man, if you ask me the biggest difference between Golovkin and Chavez and why I would pick Golovkin over Chavez, it's simple. It's because of professionalism. Like you said, you know, when you began your statement, you said you don't know which Chavez is going to show up. Well, the problem with that for Chavez is we do know which Golovkin is going to show up. And you know what? We haven't seen enough of the great Chavez or the good Chavez to consistently feel that, you know what, he's going to show up. You just don't know. I would think he would show up for Golovkin. He knows what Golovkin brings, and he knows how important this fight is. But he knew the same thing about Sergio Martinez, and he didn't fight till the 12th round. He just
right.
basically followed him around, was a punching bag. So, my prediction, you know, even aside of sharper technique, aside of what both men show me in the ring, I can take it and say, what do both men show me on the way to the ring in the months preceding the fight? And when it comes to that, Golovkin's much more professional. And a lot of times that makes a difference. To me, again, that's one reason why Vladimir Klitschko has been on top of the heavyweight division for so long. I've told this story before. I met Vladimir Klitschko a good few months out before his fight with David Haye. I mean, a good few months out. And he
right.
looked phenomenal. He looked absolutely – he looked in phenomenal shape. And, you know, he wasn't in a fight camp at the time. He was in New York. He was in phenomenal
right.
shape. And that was one of the big things. Golovkin's another one of those guys who's pretty much in shape year-round. Chavez, if he's not fighting, he's getting high and eating Cheerios first thing in the morning. That's what he does. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's worked for him so far, but, you know, it won't. It absolutely won't, you know. And you know, back in the day, I mean, they wouldn't even let the fighters be around women up to a week before the fight.
Right. You know, but see, the one thing that we know, and this is where the questions lie about Golovkin. Chavez has fought one truly elite opponent. He's lost. He made a good account of himself in one round, but, you know, outside of that, he was thoroughly outboxed for 11-plus rounds. Golovkin has fought no elite opponents. Even after he fights and quite possibly defeats Chavez, he still will have not fought or defeated an elite opponent. And so when you look at Golovkin, you know he's very, very good. But we don't know how good. We don't know if he's elite yet. Again, Lucien Boutte looked elite when he was beating Liberato Andrade and Edson Miranda. But then when he fought his first truly elite opponent, Carl Froch, he was run over. He was bulldozed. So, again, no matter how good some of these guys look against, you know, B-plus, B-level competition, once they fight the best of the best, that's when you truly know. You know what I mean? Deontay Wilder, we were speaking of him. He looked good against Malik Scott. Malik Scott is B-minus competition. It's when you fight the A-level competitions, that's when the truth comes out. That's why that ring, that square circle is a haven of truth, because you can't lie to yourself. You can lie to everyone else, but you can't lie to yourself. And so, again, when Chavez goes to fight Golovkin, no matter what he tells everyone, he'll know if he's really 100% the Chavez he needs to be to withstand a Golovkin.
Yeah, and you know, it's like the Deontay Wilder fight you just alluded to. That was I think a situation where, and Malik is a very good fighter. I think you're right, though. I think he's a B-level fighter, but. I think, yeah, but, you know, then Deontay Wilder, who's 28, who does he fight next? I mean, who's his next?
He supposedly has, I think, already mandated that he has the winner of the title fight between Chris Areola and Bermanice Stiverne, which is going to be televised on ESPN. Deontay Wilder is slated to get the winner. So in his next fight, again, without truly being tested, Malik was the guy who's supposed to test him.
Yeah.
Didn't quite work out that way. So in his next fight, without truly being tested, he's going to be in with, you know, and that happens a lot of times when you fight the champion. When you fight the champion, typically you're in with the best fighter you've ever been in your career.
Yeah.
And for Deontay Wilder, it will be true. He's going to be in with the best fighter he's ever been in with at this juncture in his career. And that's where you'll get the answers. Again, the same thing, Golovkin. If we get a motivated Chavez at 168, Golovkin will be in with the best fighter he's been in with his entire career. Chavez might not be able to say the same thing. Sergio could have been the best fighter he's been in, better than Golovkin. We don't know. And that's what the fights are for. And that's what we thought Malik, again, was going to – Malik was definitely, for our heads and shoulders, the best opponent Deontay Wilder had been in with. And, you know,
yeah,
fortunate for Deontay Wilder, he dispatched Malik pretty easily. And so, again, It's going to take maybe another level of opponent to get these questions answered.
Yeah, but is it a disservice to Wilder at this point, because he hasn't gone past, I think, the fourth round in any of his professional fights?
I always think it's a disservice when you protect the fighter, no matter how marketable or how talented they are, because there's going to come a point in time where they're going to have to fight someone. And a lot of times, if that guy's been protected, he's really not prepared for that. One guy that Zito and I talk about, and it's a guy that we like a lot, but it's Andre Berto. Andre Berto was basically fed a steady stream of HBO, fights on his way to fighting for a vacant title against Mickey Garcia, and not of the Garcia clan, just Miguel Garcia. And from that point on, he just fought a couple mandatories. So when he was truly in the ring against a quality world-class opponent, by the time he fought that person, it looked like he had regressed. And that was Victor Ortiz. It actually looked like Andre Berto had regressed from where he was when he first hit the scene. And part of that reason was because he never had to use all the tools in dispatching the foes that was given to him. He was somewhat protected. He didn't fight the fights that would have developed him into a battle-hardened warrior, and it kind of cost him. Deontay Wilder is kind of in the same boat right now. I mean, Malik Scott, again, was supposed to be that fight, but up until the Malik Scott fight, Deontay Wilder hadn't really fought anyone. And, I mean, he had a couple of names on his resume, but, these guys were pretty much past it. Sergey Lakovich was
right.
Well past it. He had already been beaten up by Brian Jennings. So it is somewhat of a disservice, because all of a sudden, if you put a guy in the fire and he doesn't know how to cope with it because he's never seen it before, and you know what can happen? Sometimes it can ruin a fighter. Speaking of fighters like that, let's think of a guy from Coatesville. Remember Michael Grant?
Yeah.
Deontay Wilder, to some people, reminds a lot of people of Michael Grant in the sense that he's a big, physically imposing heavyweight who looks really good, looks the part, but he just doesn't seem, or he may not have everything it takes to be a world champion. I remember when Michael Grant was coming along, and he fought Andrew Gallada, and he went to hell with Andrew Gallada. Andrew Gallada took him to hell and back before Andrew Gallada imploded, as Andrew Gallada was often known to do. And part of the reason why Michael Grant was in that situation, he kind of like Deontay Wilder, didn't have a diverse amateur background. Of course, Deontay Wilder accomplished much more in the amateurs. And, Michael Grant didn't have Deontay Wilder's athletic speed and power. But at the same time, you just don't know, right, until you put a guy in the ring with a guy that can truly test him. And Michael Grant looked the part, but when he was finally placed in the ring with the Golovkin, after beating more solid foes than Deontay Wilder has beaten, when he was put in the ring with a guy who could at least withstand his power and withstand his size and his natural attributes early, all of a sudden the questions were answered. He didn't take the best parts. He had heart, but he didn't have the best technique. You could see these things once he was in a ring with a true fighter. So therefore, when he fought against Lennox Lewis and he was knocked out, it really wasn't a surprise to a lot of people. Deontay Wilder, I don't think anyone would necessarily expect him to beat a Klitschko, but we don't even know if he could be in a fight with a Klitschko at this point, because he hasn't proven that he could. We don't know if he can. We know he can win. We know he's a great front runner. You know what I mean? He's like Michael Martz's St. Louis Rams, greatest show on turf. We know what he can do offensively. We know if he gets the ball, we know he's going to rack up the points. I mean, because the kid is just that gifted physically. But what happens when your offense is stalling that day? What happens if you can't land that shot? Malik Scott is a good defensive fighter. And so the whole thought process was, Malik doesn't have the hardest punch, but if Deontay can't land that Scott quickly on Malik, which is a good chance that he could, we thought, that Malik could take him in the later rounds, and with his boxing ability, he could touch up on Deontay a little bit. Maybe not hurt him with big punches, but touch up on him and make Deontay start to question himself. Never got to that point. And so what happens? Does he fight for a title and all of a sudden have to answer those questions? Some people can. George Groves fought Carl Froch in England. He lost the fight controversially, but he was able to answer those questions of himself. And so subsequently they're having a rematch. And we now know that George Groves at least proved that he belongs on that level. The questions are still all about Deontay Wilder.
Well, I mean, he's fought 54 rounds. with 31 knockouts. I mean, that's a little over one round per fight.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I mean, the guy has. I'm not saying he's not a warrior. The guy's a warrior. I'm not doubting that. But you know, there's questions, like you said, that have to be answered. I mean, he really hasn't fought anybody. You know, Malik Scott, like you said, is the only one. I mean, Malik Scott had one loss. But yeah, I mean, he really hasn't fought anybody of any note aside from Malik, and then Ciari Lekolovic.
Malik and Lekolovic, yeah.
Yeah.
And again, Lekolovic, you know, in his prime, he was a pretty good fighter, but he was well past his prime. Again, he had been beaten up pillar to post by Brian Jennings by the time Deontay fought him. So, again, we don't know. But Deontay, and one thing I do believe about Deontay Wilder, on any given night, there's not one man on the planet that kid can't knock out. I believe just because of his tremendous speed and power for his size, he has something in his fist that's just scary. I honestly think he has that type of power that if he caught any heavyweight clean, he's capable of knocking either Klitschko out. And I don't say that about Vitaly, but I think Deontay Wilder has that type of power. However,
yeah,
it's not always easy to land that shot against these world-class fighters. Just ask anyone who's fought Vladimir Klitschko. Most people don't think Vladimir has a great chin, but yet for the past, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 years, no one's been able to really land that shot, have they? So,
right.
Again,
no.
It's one thing to possess the artillery to destroy a nation. It's another thing to possess the technology to be able to fire the artillery to destroy the nation. And I don't know if Deontay possesses the technique as opposed to technology to be able to get his artillery to land on a world-class foe before they start touching on him. So that's where it becomes interesting.
Ty, we are joined now by Dan Birmingham. Dan, thanks for coming on the show tonight. How are you?
Good. You're welcome. How you guys doing?
Doing real
good.
Well. Dan, it's a pleasure to have you on. Been really admiring your work for years, sir.
Same here. Thank you.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about Keith Thurman? He's obviously the pupil you have that's at the moment, you know, getting a lot of publicity. Tell us about his development as a fighter. He looked to be a pretty strong puncher early on, but when I saw him fought Jesus Luis Soto Caras, when he fought Soto Caras, I was blown away by his ability to box him into a beating as opposed to just trucking him. So you want to talk a little bit about his development and technique and footwork especially. Wow.
When Ben Getty, one of my close friends and Keith's trainer and mentor, passed away 6 years ago, I knew that Keith can punch, but I wanted to work on his boxing ability. So even before then, he was boxing with Winky Wright and Jeff Lacy, Chad Dawson, and holding his own at 15 years old with those three right there. It was amazing. We knew he was special then. So when I took over, I started working on movement and footwork and using the jab. I have a theory in boxing with my guys that I don't want 5 seconds to go by without at least a jab, and most of the time a jab. And then we work off that. So that's the theory that I've tried to get through to Keith, and he's been real receptive with it.
When Keith first came on the scene, he reminded me, not style-wise, but just substance-wise, it's kind of like a younger Shane Mosley in the sense that because of, you know, he has some tremendous physical gifts and he was able to, you know, just really truck a lot of people and you know, a lot of quality people, too. This is a guy who wasn't fed a steady diet of guys that weren't, you know, he was fed developmental fights. He was brought up well, I thought, and he was really impressive in his ability to overwhelm these guys. And the gentleman, I can't remember his name, but the guy he fought before Soto Caras, that was the fight where he really showed me that where I really learned that, man, you guys had really worked on his boxing footwork, fundamentals, technique, and then the Soto Caras fight, again, just, you know, comparative shopping. Just remember how the Andre Berto fight went against Soto Caras, and then, you know, watching Keith Thurman and him using his feet to get out of trouble. And not only that, but to set traps for Soto Caras, who was supposedly the wily veteran. Keith is the young guy. And I saw him setting traps. Karash, you want to talk about how coachable this kid has become?
Well, he's very coachable, and also he's very intelligent and very creative. You know, we work a lot on what we call our come-forward movement, where we're stutter-stepping and juking and feinting, and, you know, we practice that constantly, trying to be on balance, ready to strike, you know, at any given moment. I think that's kind of a lost art. If you look at the old-time fighters, you know, Ezra Charles and Ray Robinson and guys like that, they would set you up, but they would never make their approach the same way each time. They would, you know, they would change their rhythm, they would juke, they would feint, you know, and they would go deep into their arsenal just to land their punches. And to me, that's a lost art, but it's something I think that Keith is bringing back.
Now, it looks like something that you guys also have Keith doing is changing up the velocity of his punches. As opposed to throwing everything hard, I noticed he's changing the speed. He's also changing the power of his punches. It looks like he's really learned to set guys up as opposed to just blast them out. Does it seem like because of that, is he more relaxed in the ring, stamina even better now?
Oh, yeah, definitely. He's learned how to, you know, scatter his punches. He's learned how to change his rhythm. You know, he'll break his rhythm and strike, you know, like the great fighters do. I mean, there's a lot of great things yet to come from this guy.
He fought a couple fights at 154. Is 147 his home for the time being, or do you guys have aspirations on moving up to 154 soon? Or are you looking for the big ticket item at 147 before you talk about 154 at all?
Well, we took those fights mainly because nobody would fight him. He couldn't get a meaningful fight. You know, we didn't want to fight just anybody. We wanted meaningful fights that would mean something to advance his career. So we took those fights, you know, a little heavy. But, no, he makes 47 easy. I mean easy, he makes 47. Walks around about 65,
you know,
something like that, and then brings it down. He's a big welterweight.
Yeah, he is.
You know, and without looking like, you know, like overly muscular or anything, he's a, you know, really strong guy. He gets that from his dad. His dad is short, you know, and his shoulders are about 3 feet wide. That's where Keith gets that strength.
Yeah, because Keith, he's a pretty imposing welterweight. And I thought he looked pretty strong at junior middle, too. When didn't he dispatch Carlos Quintana at junior middle?
Pardon me?
I thought he looked pretty strong there as well. So, you know, when I heard he was going down to welterweight personally.
Actually, we fought Quintana at 47, I'm sorry.
Oh, that was at 47, okay. Yeah, but I know he looked very strong at junior middle, too. How old is Keith, 25?
Yeah, he's 25.
That's plenty of time to grow in junior middle if he needs to go there. Would you guys take a fight, per se, with the Canelo Alvarez, or if it were offered at 154?
No doubt about it. Keith would beat Canelo. We wanted to fight Canelo. They wouldn't let us fight. They said later on down the road when it'll mean something, you know, and I guess that means that Keith would have to build his name, too, you know, make it a mega fight. So we're not far away from him or Mayweather.
And not enough reward. That's what they were trying to tell you.
Yeah, well, you know, Keith's got that philosophy about the risk thing, but at this stage, we'll fight anybody. It doesn't matter. We want Mayweather is what we want. Of course, who don't? And we've been promised the winner of Malignaggi and Porter, so we'll see how that surfaces. But we've got to get by Julio Diaz first on the 26th.
Right. You want to talk a little bit about Julio Diaz. The last time we seen him, he was taking Americana hell and back.
Oh, he's a good fighter, good, solid fighter, former world champion at lightweight, but has moved up effectively and gave world champion Sean Porter two real tough fights, you know, And like you say, well, you know, to me, Khan's a lot of hype anyway, but anyway, and he wouldn't fight Keith. He turned Keith down, too. He's another one that turned Keith down. They're all turning him down.
Yeah, Diaz has basically had a career renaissance since he moved up to welterweight. I mean, he fought Sean Porter. He had a draw with him once that a lot of people thought he won.
Yeah, the first
fought him very close the second fight. And,
yes.
I mean, really fought Amir Khan tooth and nail and actually lost the decision, but probably won an ass-whooping, though, actually, in that fight. So, I mean, he's a tough fighter. You guys, again, you're sticking with your theme of picking a tough Mexican fighter to fight, man.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we don't want easy fights at this stage. Like I said, we need meaningful fights. We want the road to Mayweather. And from what we understand, we're only a few fights away. So Keith's planning on making a statement every time he gets out there. can't ask for more than that. Could you
guys,
tell
we're
us
also
about...
we're also joined by Dr. Chris Panarello.
Okay, hey Chris.
How
Dr.
are you,
Panarello?
Hey,
guys. Good, good.
What's going on?
We're just discussing. Dan Birmingham's on with us, and I wanted to bring you on so you could give your perspective.
All right.
Go ahead, Chris.
I'm listening.
Oh, well, we were talking about Keith Thurman. We were talking about Julio Diaz and Keith's, you know, fight coming up with him April 26th in Carson, California, where the main event on Showtime. And, you know, we're looking forward to a tough fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know what? I'm not really familiar. You know, I haven't seen those two guys fight an awful lot.
You haven't seen Thurman fight?
I think you saw the Thurman. You saw when Keith Thurman fought Soto Karas, right?
Yeah, well, if you haven't seen him fight, you better go see him fight because he's the most exciting guy out there right now. There's no other welterweight that's exciting as Keith Thurman, maybe in any other division either.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Right there. What time is the fight on?
It's the main event in California, so I don't know. Probably, I don't know, you got a three-hour difference here, so it would probably be something like 9 o'clock, 8 or 9 o'clock, something like that.
Later than that, probably.
Well, I mean, in California, California it'll be 8 or 9 o'clock. Over here it'll be 11, 12 o'clock, I'm sure.
So if you guys are going to California to fight Julio Diaz, you're basically fighting him in his town, aren't you?
Yeah, he's from Coachella, and that's fine. We'll go to his hometown.
I was about to say, that's a road fight for you guys. You guys are becoming like Glenn Johnson, isn't he? Because I know he wanted to fight Paulie Malignaggi in Brooklyn, so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We don't mind going on the road. We don't mind going on the road. We fought in California before. They're fair.
Hey, Dan, could you tell us a little bit about your work with Edner Cherry? You're getting a veteran that you're working with now. Tell us how that's been going.
It's going well. I've known Edner since he was a kid, since he was an amateur, and seen him around a lot, and we've been friends for a long time. He called me a few months ago and asked me if I'd work with him, and he's such a great kid, I couldn't say no. I mean, he's really a quality guy, really is. He's got 40 pro fights. He was putting two world title fights, you know, up at 140. And with Malignaggi and what's his name, little shorty?
Tim Bradley.
Yeah, Tim Bradley. And, you know, he's a 130-pounder, and he's probably one of the strongest in the world. He really is. I think, you know, if his fights are made right at 130, you're going to see him surface real quick.
Yeah,
go ahead, Frankie.
Edner Cherry is an absolute class act guy. I really like him. Bobby and he were very good friends. That guy, he is just, you know, he's very humble, very nice, very polite. You know, you got a great fighter there.
Yeah, he's really a good guy, you're right, and strong. You know, I've been working with him. I'm getting him to try to settle down and be more consistent with his style because he's kind of a stop, herky-jerky kind of guy. And I'm just trying to get him to relax and just let everything flow, you know, working on his feint and his jab and everything else, but just trying to get a theory going with him where he doesn't stop, you know, and then try to explode and then stop again, you know, because then you become a predictable fighter. And I'm just trying to get that message.
How's his power at 130?
Oh, my God. It's unbelievable. It really is. It really is. I mean, he is one strong guy, and he knows how to punch. He knows how to punch. I've been working with him trying to go to the left more for the left hook to the body because he likes to do everything off the right side. And then, you know, I'm trying to teach him how to get moves to the left side now. So stuff like
so
that.
So now, at this stage in Edner's game, how tough is it to add that much to a veteran? It's not like you're adding a lot. I'm sure these are fundamentals that he was probably taught as an amateur. But, again, as we in use, we did used to being able to just do the things that are successful for us. So how's he adapting to these different layers that are being added to him?
Well, he told me after the first, I think, 3 days that I worked with him that he learned more in the last 3 days than he did his whole career.
Wow.
And I'm not the only one helping him. Keith Thurman is a big help in the gym. He's a big help in the gym. He works with the kids. He helps everybody in there. And he's got a brilliant, creative mind. He really does. You got to know Keith to understand him. You know, and he has a way of getting to them and making them understand the points he's trying to get across. He'll make a good announcer someday, or trainer, whatever he wants to do.
Wow. You just said you're trying to get your fighter to go on the left side and throw left hooks to the body?
Yeah, he likes to let his left hook go when he's directly out in front or even to the right side sometimes, which is okay.
You know what happens a lot of times with guys who are just starting that? When they move over to the left to throw left hooks, they square up to the opponent. They're very vulnerable uppercuts.
Yeah, but if you teach them the right movement and the right way to make the approach and the right way to get the position, it's not that hard.
My old trainer used to make me bring my right elbow to the middle of my body when I went left to stop that uppercut, because it doesn't feel too good when you square up and go left. You're right on the bottom of the damn nose, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why, it's pretty hard. It's a hard move. You can learn it fast. Just step over on get all your weight on your left side, throw it to the body.
The key is to step offline. That is the key, to step left offline.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Back foot forward. Glove is
position. If he stays in an upright position, he's very vulnerable to counter right hand. So he's got to kind of bend over to go to the body. If he stays up and drops his left hand down, his whole left side is vulnerable to right hand. So it's a pretty tricky thing.
Yeah, but the beautiful thing about that technique is once you get that weight on that front left foot and you taking that half step or step out and you shifted that weight and stepped offline, it really puts you in position to the body. Jesus, I mean, you can really bust the rib.
You know
who did it faster and better than anybody? Mike Tyson.
Mike Tyson,
he could come in. I remember when the big guy from South Jersey, Truth Williams, Carmen Graziano said, "We know how to beat Tyson." I said, "Carmen, I know what you're going to tell me. Truth's 6'4". He's going to throw uppercuts. How'd you know?" I said, "Well, everybody thinks Tyson is vulnerable to uppercuts. He will be one time. Then he'll move over to his left, and he'll come over the top of the left hook. He'll take Truth's head off. And no sooner than Truth threw the uppercut, my son and I both said, 'Uh-oh. Look out for the next one.' He did it again. Tyson stepped over. And when he hit Truth Williams, he fell over like a tree."
I remember that.
You remember that fight? That was a left
hook.
Remember that Carl, the Truth, was had like stage fright before the fight. He looked scared to death.
Stage fright is a generous way to term it.
Yeah, he tried to box. I remember he tried to box, but Tyson just cut the ring off and then was over.
Yeah. The left hook to the body works better when you're inside, because the guy doesn't have a hell of a lot of room to throw his right hand counter. And it's an art, though. It takes a while.
It really is an art.
Very few guys can do it. Carmen, I mentioned, if I think back over my lifetime, you remember watching Chavez fight?
Yeah, Chavez could get
Chavez
it off.
Chavez used to throw his left hook to the body from a stand-up position.
Yes, he did.
And then along came a right-hander that threw a right hand. Same time he threw left hook, started knocking Chavez's head off.
Oh, yeah,
it was a lightweight. I can't remember the guy's name.
Frankie Randall,
that's it.
Wow.
I said, I'm waiting for the day somebody wises up and realizes that he's vulnerable. And Frankie Randall blasted him with right hands. I know the worst punch I ever got hit with in my life was when I squared up and went left, and the guy threw an uppercut, caught me on the bottom of the nose. He broke my septum, and I had a concussion the next day.
It really is. You're going down, and the price is coming in.
You're right.
It's a double hit.
You're right. You're right. Whenever you go to get position for the left hook, you're right in the line of fire of the right hand. That's why you have to be real tricky with it and get that position real slick and quick and at the right time. Otherwise, you're right. I mean, you're right in the line of fire.
Yeah, you know what's so good about that punch, too, is it also, if you can land it enough and set it up, it really opens up the overhand right, too. That's how Marquez knocked down Pacquiao in that second or third round of that last fight.
He caught
him with a couple of left hooks to the body. He kept sliding left, throwing that left hook to the body. When he feinted left, Pacquiao dropped his left glove. Along came the right over the top. It really sets up so much if you can do that.
That was a good execution.
The middleweight, what's his name, Golovkin? The middleweight,
he throws
the best left hook to the body I've seen in a long, long time. And he does it fast. I think he's tremendous. I thought Bernard Hopkins was fighting the Russian tonight. Am I wrong?
No, he's not fighting Shumanev tonight.
No.
That's April 21st, maybe? April 19th, I think that is. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Dan, I have a quick question for you as a trainer. Before we got you on, Ty and I were talking about the Malik Scott Danny Wilder fight, and Wilder has only boxed 54 rounds with 31 wins. And Keith, drawing a comparison with Keith Thurman, Keith has started to go deeper into rounds. Is it harder to train a fighter that has such overwhelming power to go deeper into a round?
Well, you have to look at the quality of opposition. I mean, we've been fighting some pretty good guys. And, our theory is to box them, outbox them, stay with them, and, the opportune time is going to take place, and it's usually in the later rounds, maybe 9 to 12. But, that's what's been happening. These guys are tough guys we're fighting. We're not fighting easy fights. Not to say he's fighting easy fights, but he's getting easier fights, that's for sure. And he's a big, strong guy. We'll see if he can box these better guys, especially the Klitschko.
Yeah, it seems like Malik Scott was really the only one that would have been or was perceived as a potential threat to him. But, I mean, Keith is fighting guys that you guys definitely have not ducked any fights by any means. And do you start to teach them after, what are you honing right now? What do you feel he needs to work on for the Diaz fight?
Well, actually, we work on about everything. I mean, we don't really pick one thing. I just want Keith to be Keith. We're working on movement, and increasing our speed, our reflexology, trying to be quicker and slicker and, more deliberate. He's making advances. He's still a young guy, but he's 25 years old. He's got a heck of an arsenal right now.
Where do you feel he's at defensively right now?
Pardon me?
Where do you feel he's at defensively?
He's a real good defensive fighter. I mean, he uses his movement, his legs, his hands to block. He uses his legs a lot. You see him always in a rhythm, always stutter stepping and fainting, and changing his rhythm just to confuse his
opponent.
His movement alone, he's making guys miss a lot.
And he's also seeming able to use his movement and still carry his power in a later round. So,
yes. Well, we work our ass off in the gym. That's like a big thing. I mean, he did 14 rounds yesterday. I mean, just real tough mitts. I mean, 14 straight rounds. And sometimes we'll go 2-3 rounds without a rest.
14 rounds
we do that.
Of mitts?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
That's the way we work. And we'll do heavy bag work. A lot of times we'll work 3 rounds. Last week he did 6 rounds straight. I mean hard punching on a heavy bag too, without a break. 6 rounds, 6 3-minute rounds, 1-minute rest. So that's like 24 minutes straight. And then we did 3 straight and 3 more straight. So we did like 12 rounds that day, but with different rest periods.
The average person doesn't quite understand that 14 rounds of mitt work or 14 rounds of heavy bat work is actually more exhausting than 14 rounds of sparring, because you are basically punching nonstop, right? Am I right? You're punching nonstop.
Well, anybody that knows the way I do mitts, if you do work mitts with me, you're in a fight with me because I'm hitting you. I'm hitting you with all the punches, you know,
right.
And I'm making lip, you know, and I'm making you work. It's a fight. I'm not standing there saying one, two, three, you know, like that. You can ask anybody that's worked a mitts with me, and if you do it that way, it's even better than sparring sometimes.
Uh-huh.
You know, with Winky Wright, there were times when he were coming up, we had no money. We couldn't get sparring. Nobody would spar with him. So even some of his first pro fights, before his first 10 pro fights or so, all we did was mitts. All we did was mitts, and he'd look sharp. So it's they can be a real effective teaching and conditioning
tool. Oh, yeah. Hey, Dan, when you said you don't take the one-minute break, that's how
right.
When I first started and Rocky Jones was in the gym, these are old fighters, the old trainer used to go 6 and 7 minute rounds. You learn to pace yourself because you know you got to fight 6 minutes straight. So you don't go all out and you don't keep your arms tense. Do you remember George Foreman, how tense he was by the fifth round? He was gasping for air.
Yes.
You know, he could use more of that 6 minute round type thing, and then he wouldn't be so damn tense. I think that's a very good way to train somebody. It's a very valuable way to train somebody to go straight through and don't take the minute break. That way you got that in your head, preserve my energy. I gotta be there and at the end of 5 minutes, I don't want to get murdered. I got to have something in the tank, and that's a great way to train. You're the first guy I ever heard say that.
Well, and then
but it goes back a long way. That's what they used to do years ago in the 50s, early 50s. They would go right through the rounds. There's 6, 7 minutes.
Yes.
Damn, your tongue would be hanging out when you first do it. You know, you want that bell to ring, and then pretty soon you learn to pace yourself. Doesn't take you long. So I'm glad to hear that. That's it.
I'll tell you, Chris, we jumped rope for an hour just to warm up, 1 hour straight. And I've seen Keith Thurman, the only fighter, and Keith Thurman is the only fighter, and I watched him with my own eyes. Jump rope for 2 hours straight without stopping and without missing.
Jeez.
2 hours. Two hours straight. And there were several guys in the gym that seen him do it. So, you
that's
know,
a great
you know,
aerobic
looked,
benefit for him. If he could do that, is if the longer you can keep your heartbeat at a certain point, the better condition you get in. That's great. I didn't know that.
What people don't understand, too, is that jumping rope is basically Keith Thurman saying, you know what, I can dance around the ring for 2 hours because he's on
his
toes for two hours. Yeah, and that's the whole purpose of jumping rope is to be on your toes for 2 hours.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Well, what I told him when I took over, like I said, when Ben Getty passed away, I told Keith, I said, you're a puncher. I said, but a guy that can box and punch is really tough to beat because most guys can do a little bit one way or the other. But if you can be a really good boxer and pick your spots when to use your power and be smart about it, you'd be really tough to beat. And it's coming to pass.
Yeah. Yeah, because you think a guy like Soto Karaz had no choice because he's a pressure fighter to really basically – come towards a puncher at all times. At all times, he was chasing a puncher, and that's a very dangerous proposition for anyone.
Yes, yes, yeah. And he hurt Keith, you know, with the opening bell. He marched out. Keith dropped his right hand. He got caught with a hook on a ropes, and, it shook him up a little bit, but he shook it off.
Roberto Duran used to skip rope for prolonged periods of time.
Uh-huh.
He was about the best I ever saw. I swear to God, he was the best I ever saw at skipping rope. He did all kind of tricks, and he'd do it for a long time, like you just said. He never stopped at 3 minutes. He went through it, the condition he was in. It's going to be, now you got me all interested in your fighter. I want to see him fight.
Dr. Chris, when you see him, you're going to be like, oh, I remember this kid. Yeah, I like him. I always thought this kid could punch hard. Yeah, this kid's developed some things. That's what you're
saying.
I know,
I've seen him before, but sometimes the name doesn't sink in, you know? Last night I watched a rerun of Bradley and I call him Biletnikoff because I can't remember his name.
Biletnikoff.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I go after that pro Freddie Biletnikoff, the receiver. That's all I remember.
I know.
What a fight. What a fight. That kid's got all the guts and heart in the world. And Bradley showed a lot of guts.
Yeah,
you know,
Bradley's a tough fighter.
Well, he's not a big 147 pounder, and that kid looked bigger than him. And you know, that last round, he damn near knocked Bradley the hell out. But you got to give Bradley credit. He was in it. Boy, you know, he fought back hard. He's going to do better against Pacquiao this fight than he did in the first fight. That's for sure.
I think
he'll do much better.
Okay.
I'm anxious to see that fight too.
I'm going to lean with Pacquiao in that one. I think Pacquiao has to prove this fight. Because I thought he won the last one.
I think Bradley has to do significantly better and still lose a clean decision. I thought Pacquiao won the fight pretty clearly last time. I think Bradley can improve. I think Bradley can completely improve upon that performance and still come out the loser fairly. So.
Yeah, that's a good analogy there.
Is Aram the promoter? Anything could happen.
Aram's
going to promote the fight. Look out.
You know, that's a good subject for you guys to talk about. You know, the problems with, you know, the National League and the American League of Boxing and why we can't make the big fights because of the promotional differences. That would be a good topic for you guys.
We actually talk about that every week.
Okay.
I don't think we can talk boxing without speaking about that. You know, just the fact that realistically, I can't see Keith Thurman fight Tim Bradley or Keith Thurman fight Manny Pacquiao at this point in time. Realistically, it's a promotional cold war is what I actually like to call it because just won't happen. It just won't happen. And so, you know, it's the fans who suffer. Thank God, you know, people always talk about boxing's dead. But guys like Keith Thurman prove there's still a lot of talent in the boxing. Even a guy like Amir Khan, who I believe Khan's a bit overhyped. But at the same time, it proves that there's a lot of young talent in the boxing. Khan's a guy who's only like 25 or 26. So boxing is nowhere near dead. It's just in the malaise because it's the malaise that is created by having things like a promotional cold war, no national commission, things of those nature. So
Well, I hope I can get the results.
Hey, Dan, don't you think there's a lot of young fighters they're entering the game because in 15 or 16 fights you can get a title shot. You used to sit around for 5 years in the 50s. LaMotta didn't get a title shot till he was almost 30. You know, if you had 40 or 50 fights, you could get it. But now these kids are getting in there with 15, and they're making money earlier, and they don't have to get beat up fighting 80 and 100 fights.
I see a lot
of good talent. These six-rounders that they're putting on, there's a lot of good talent in the game. It's just a matter of time that they develop. And you got the Russians, the Poles, you got the foreigners coming in. Everybody... is going after the buck now, and they're going to get a lot more worldwide talent in this, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, back in the day, you only had one federation. You only had one major federation. That's why you guys had to wait so long. But now you've got four major federations, so there's a lot more opportunities, and then they try to create super fights from there. So the business has changed.
And they have more divisions now. They got 135, 140, 147, 154, 160. You didn't have that before. You had to move up. If somebody wanted to fight with a welder, wanted to fight for the middleweight title, there's a gap of 13 pounds there. That's a lot of weight ring-wise. That's a lot of weight, 13 pounds.
Like Ray Robinson started at 47 and then at light to heavyweight. I mean,
I got something I didn't know until I read this in one of my books the other day. How many fights do you think Ray Robinson had before he lost one?
76, was it?
Yeah, there was a...
I thought it was 68, but I could be... But and Willie Pep had the second most.
Uh-huh.
Willie Pep was 60-0, then he lost to the lightweight champion, and then he went on another tear for 60-foot. And then until he met Sandy Sadler, he got into a bad plane accident, fought Sadler too soon after the accident. Sadler knocked him out, but they judged Willie Pep's career by what he did after he was in that bad plane accident.
Uh-huh.
Got beat up pretty good. But I was surprised. I remember I remember Marty Servo being the welterweight champion, and him and Robinson fought, and there would be like a 1 point difference in 10 rounds. They were very close, and Robinson won both decisions. And he was 68, and I think LaMotta was the first guy ever to beat him.
Yeah,
beat him in Detroit because Sugar Ray was screwing around and wasn't taking care of himself, you know. and he wanted to fight in Detroit, and LaMotta was the only guy that would go fight anywhere else but New York. So, and Sugar Ray in his book admits, he said, I didn't train right for the fight. He said, when I stepped in the ring and I saw the yoke body over there, he said, I knew I was in trouble. He said, and damn if he didn't knock me down with body shots. He said, I learned my lesson. Well, I didn't realize. It was 68 or 70. It might have been 70. I forget. It was some high number, the highest of all time. That's phenomenal.
I don't know why I thought it was 76. I don't know why 76 is the number that pops in my head. I just remember seeing 76 and 1 for some reason.
Well, those guys fought every couple weeks, too.
Yeah, they did. They did. But, you know, we were talking about the oversaturation of the titles and the dilution of the boxing game, and I think it's a testament as smart that Keith was brought up in a very developmental way because, he, you know, obviously Keith is getting TV exposure. So he could have been thrown into some pretty, you know, if guys had been willing to fight him, he could have been thrown into some pretty easy fights that would have given him, you know, maybe more name recognition, so to speak, but they wouldn't have developed him as a fighter. But I think
he has been
brought along in a way that's completely developed him for the bigger things in this game.
And there's a reason for that, too, because Ben Getty, you know, he scrutinized every fight, and he was real smart about it. He didn't want to give Keith any easy fights, and he didn't want to put him in over his head, but he did want a little bit of a test almost every fight. So if you look on BoxRec, he didn't fight guys that had sub-5 records. You know, he fought decent guys. I think, like, I forget which fight, but, like, he was 5-0, and he fought, world champion Bell's younger brother, who was, I think, 7-0, you know, and Ben says, no, I want a little test. Let's see what he can do, and he knocked him out in the first round, you know. But Keith said,
Carlos Quintana when he did. I mean, I Keith had been a guy, you know, just as a fan, I had been kind of had my eye on for a little bit. But when he fought Quintana, I was like, it's a little soon. You know what I mean? I was like, Keith could punch hard, but, you know, I mean, Quintana,
yeah, but
not
we
as
knew
bad.
He was
it's
ready by
horrible.
What he, we knew he was real ready for that by what he did with Winky Wright in the gym, you know. He boxed with Winky for, years and years, and I used to bring him to camp with me. Him and Ben both, and you know, Keith would be a sparring partner for these top guys, and he learned a lot. He learned a lot. He won 6 national amateur titles. I mean, that's another thing. His amateur pedigree was, you know, he lost to Andrade in the finals, who we had beaten before and didn't get to go to the Olympics, but he was right in the mix there.
That's a sign of a great fighter when you fight. You fight to the level of your competition. A lot of guys, you know, they move up, they fight at the level. They're better against better opponents. They concentrate better. They focus better. So that's a good sign. I'll look for that next time when I see the fight. That's going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
So, 6 national titles, you said?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's a hell of a lot of national titles.
Well, he started training when he was 7 years old with Ben. Ben started when he was 7 years old. And by the time he was 14, Ben and him came to my gym, and, you know, Ben was helping me and had keys to my gym like it was their own gym. That's the way it's been. And then Ben passed away 6 years ago. It was 2009. It was 2008. Yeah, 2008. He passed away in May, and then my brother Mike passed away 2 months later.
Mm.
Both heart attacks. Mike was getting out of the shower. Ben passed away at home, and then Mike passed away stepping out of the shower one afternoon. And it was a big loss. It was a huge loss to our gym. Huge, huge loss to our gym. And Keith wasn't right for years. He's still not right. Him and Ben were, you know how your trainer becomes your second father, sometimes your first.
I mean, yeah.
You know. Ben had a way of firing Keith up. You know, he when they go to the amateur tournaments, you know, Ben would tell him, "Hey, this kid said he's going to knock you out." You know, he'd say stuff like that just because it'd get under Keith's skin, because, you know, Keith is from a tough neighborhood, you know, and he's kind of edgy, you know, and you don't want to piss the guy off, even though he's never been in a street fight, which is fantastic.
Well, you know what? You have a sense of feeling. If your trainer has confidence in you, you can feel it, and then you start having confidence in yourself.
You said
and,
that.
And that's important to have that relationship, because that's how, you know, I know once my trainer started having confidence in me, I was a much better fighter. Much better.
Yes.
You know, being a slugger type, I didn't have a lot of amateur fights because they don't do a slugger as much good as they do a boxer type guy.
That's like why Fletcher, so many in the amateurs.
He must have had 125 amateur fights, and he won a lot. He won a lot of national titles because he developed his boxing skill. He wasn't a slugger. Where his brother Frankie didn't have but about three or four amateur fights. He came right out of jail, right in the ring, and he became a number one contender. So. It depends on your style, you know.
Not too many guys can do that, though. If you look at all the top fighters, most of them had a pretty decent amateur pedigree.
Truly good boxer. Mike Tyson didn't have a lot of amateur fights.
You know, Mike Tyson, he didn't have a bad amateur career, though. He lost it to Tillman in the Olympic trials. Even when you saw him lost to Tillman, you could tell. You were like, yeah, this guy was going to be more suited for the pros.
You saw
that clearly.
Yeah.
We had a guy in our gym. He was in the box off for the last, the final four with Tyson, Tillman, and other guys. And he said, I said, who'd you draw? This guy's a Princeton engineer graduate.
Wow.
He said, I drew a guy named Mike Tyson. I said, I don't know anything about him. So Carmen Graziano spoke up. He said, well, let me tell you, I speak to Gus all the time. And Gus said to me, the kid's a pure animal. He's the toughest thing I've ever seen. And he said, I got him. I'm training him. I was hoping he'd add 10 years of my life. He said, but the more I'm around him, he's going to take 10 years off of my life. He's hard to control. He said, and that's so what happened, Henry, the bell rang, Christ, Tyson climbed on him and beat the living hell out of him. It only went around, I think. But he didn't belong in there with Mike. Mike was a savage fighter when he was an amateur because he knew he only had to go three rounds. He'd come at you and try to kill you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's why he didn't have a hell of a lot of amateur fights. First of all, nobody wanted to fight him. He only had a couple of tournaments. But he had expert trainers all the way. He did have great trainers.
Most exciting fighter ever so far, Mike Tyson, no doubt about it.
He's a mean guy, man. He come after you, look out.
I see he's pretty mellowed out now with, you know, he's doing
his
show.
Well, you know, he's looking back over his life, and he realizes what made him the way he was, and I think he's actually trying to improve his personality, and he's trying to do better now. I think he's a much happier guy now.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, everybody, when you get older, you start looking back over your youth, and, you know, you wonder what made you half crazy, and then you start to realize what did, then you try to, you know, reshape your personality to make yourself more tolerable to people.
You can't get wiser as we get older. There's no reason to get older, you know.
I think Mike, he had such a stormy life. You know, he was in a state of confusion as a young man. And, you know, now that he's mellowed and he's looking back, he knows what made him the way he was, what went wrong at certain times of his life. He knows now. I like to watch, you know, his when he puts these single shows on, he tries to explain in his own words what happened. You can understand it. You know, he's like a lot of other guys. They threw their money away. Now, I'm sure he's, you know, probably got more money in his pocket now than ever because he's not blowing it.
I was impressed the way he articulated his life. He does a good job.
Yeah, right. He's done the best he can with it, you know. He's got all those tattoos on his face, and he probably wondering why the hell did I do this, you know. But he's a tough guy. He just grew up, you know. He's taken out of a reform school and adopted by Gus and moved upstate to New York, and he started fighting. That was it. That was his whole life. He never had a mellow day. He never played baseball, football, and got interacted with other kids. Let's put it that way.
He never interacted.
So he became the tough guy he was. That was very, very few guys in the future are going to come up with that type of life.
Yeah.
I feel sorry for the guy he was taken advantage of.
Yeah.
And I still think he should never have gone to jail.
Yeah.
Well, we get into some damn arguments with lawyers over that.
Yeah,
we start shouting at one another.
Yeah.
I don't think he should. I think he got railroaded, and that's it.
Yeah.
And I've had female lawyers, scream at me over that.
Well, you know how the rape situation is with the law. I mean, all the woman has to do is scream rape, and they side with her, and we don't have a leg to stand on. So that's what happened to Mike. I believe
you're right. You're right.
I mean,
Mike,
they got laid any time he wanted to.
Mike was also a victim of celebrity too. So I think all that played into his celebrity and his reputation and everything. And I think the facts kind of didn't play as much a part of the case as they should have. Guys, it's been a great evening. We've run significantly over tonight, and unfortunately we have to wrap it up. Dan, it's been an absolute pleasure and an honor having you on our show tonight, sir.
Same here.
Dan,
anytime.
I'm waiting to see what that guy, when he moves to the left now, I'm going to keep an eye on him.
All right.
I want to say
thanks for the tips, too, man.
I hope he doesn't get that nose bent.
Oh, wow.
I hope not either.
Won't be me getting hit.
Enjoy the evening. I look forward to watching the fight now. See you guys.
Yeah, nice talking to you guys. Nice talking to you guys.
Okay,
thanks,
Dr. Sam.
Okay, talk to you again.
Dan, if we can get you back on at some point, either after the fight or right before the fight, we'd love to have you back on.
Sure.
And maybe even get Keith on.
Yeah, just call me and give me a heads up. I mean, last week I took a nap. I fell asleep about 5:30 and set my phone. I thought, and it didn't go off, so I apologize. I apologize about that.
Hey, Dan, there's nothing wrong with a good nap. There's nothing wrong with a good nap.
I take many every day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, you guys. Take care.
All
talk
right.
to you soon, man.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Ty.
Yes,
Ty,
another
what a
great
show.
Great night. Yeah, and
wow,
it was kind of funny when he brought up, you know, we should talk about the unification of the titles and all that stuff. You're right. Every week we piss and moan about
that. There's not a week we don't bitch about that.
Yeah, he's
and
absolutely
literally
right.
We were bitching about it like 2 seconds before he came on.
Yeah. When there's that much money involved, people are always going to try and keep the biggest piece of pie they can.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, which is sad because I think it does dilute talent, and it dilutes the talent pool and the possibilities of big matches and desire. Matches. I mean, well, we talked about it early on with HBO and Showtime.
And ultimately, the harm is only done to the fans and to the business of boxing itself, ultimately.
Yeah. And I'm really, when I heard that Dan was working with Edner Cherry is an absolute class act. Love that guy. And I think that under Dan's tutelage, I think he could go a lot further than he has thus far.
You know, and there's a guy who's had two world title shots. He came up a little short fighting out of weight, 10 pounds overweight both times. So, you know, it also goes to show having a promotional arm that really has your best interest as a fighter at heart, what it can do for you. So now with Edna fighting at 130 with Dan Birmingham, seems like the stars are aligning for him. And he's a good home. We expect to hear some great things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, well, Ty, again, thanks so much for coming on tonight. It's been a great night. We're about a half hour over, which is great.
I like
hearing the stories. Yeah.
Well, look, it's been a great show. Look forward to seeing everybody next week. Bob is our co-pilot.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for coming on. We will see you next week then.
Good night, sir.
All right. Good night. Okay, this show and all shows on the Fighting Words Radio Network are dedicated to the memory of my brother, Robert Anthony Carroll, who dedicated his life to the Fighting Words Radio Network and built it into what it is today. Thanks for listening, guys. We're going to lead out with Bob's favorite song by the Chieftains, Mo Gamir. We'll see you guys next Friday, or we'll see you guys next Saturday, rather. And remember, Fighting Words Radio Network is a six-day-a-week network with San Clemente Punk on Monday nights. Tuesday night is Big Dog Radio with Big Dog Benny Henderson. Wednesday night is Sports Night with Tommy G, where Butch, Tommy G, and Don Henderson discuss the happenings in the world of sports. Thursday night is McGee's Back Room, which will be moving to Sundays. Friday night is Open Right Now, and then Saturday night is Fighting Words with Ty, Butch, and Zito. I'm just filling in tonight for Butch. Thanks so much for listening, guys. We will see you guys next Saturday.
Power and strength and length of